From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, unfunded pension debt threatens cities all over Michigan.
Detroit remains the extreme example of what can happen, but there are many cities in Michigan that are going to be dealing with significant financial stress.
Is there new movement in a plan to protect DIA treasures from Detroit's creditors?
But I think the feeling is this is getting better all the time.
As GM pulls one brand out of Europe, Ford decides to start selling Mustangs overseas.
Everybody wants to drive the dream.
And we take you to Muskegon's singing Christmas tree.
Seems like just about every student prefers to go as high up in the tree as possible. Everybody wants to be up at the top.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us today. A lot of attention, of course, is being paid to Detroit's bankruptcy. But it's not only Detroit facing big budget challenges. Unfunded liabilities and retiree debt are adding up all across our state, from Ann Arbor to Bloomfield Hills to Grand Rapids. We'll find out more on today's show. Then, later in the hour, did you know Muskegon is home to America's tallest singing Christmas tree? It's a West Michigan holiday tradition. We'll take you inside the show and introduce you to the people that make it possible. But first, big auto news from around the globe today. General Motors says it plans to largely withdraw its Chevrolet brand from Europe starting in 2016. The automaker says the decision was largely due to a challenging business model and the difficult economic situation in Europe. Meanwhile, the Ford Mustang marks its 50th birthday with a new design and plans to go global. Joining us from London is Russell Padmore, business reporter for the BBC. Welcome back to Stateside, Russell.
Cindy, good being with you again.
So let's start with the General Motors announcement today. What's behind that decision?
Well, you have to look at what GM's been doing here in Europe. It's been struggling to get its operation back on track. And around about 2005, from the back of my mind, was when GM decided that it would introduce the Chevrolet brand into Europe. Now, don't get carried away. The kind of Chevys we have here are not the kind that you would see on American roads. Largely, General Motors for years had had control of a South Korean manufacturer called Daewoo, and these were small budget cars. It decided that Europe was the market for these cars. 2005, they got introduced, and what GM has seen, the market changing in Europe, and ultimately, GM in a roundabout way has been competing with itself because it has brands here which are in that self-same segment of the market as the Chevrolet brand, Opel, the large German manufacturer, for example.
Sure. So what does this mean for General Motors? Is this seen as a ding in the fender, if you will?
Sure. This is what's going on here. General Motors has got no choice but to revamp its European operations. We have seen the debt crisis, particularly in the Eurozone, making a lot of people either out of work, therefore they've been hanging on to their existing car a bit longer. You could say that there are several clunkers on the roads driving around in Central Europe or Western Europe now as people decide to hang on to that car a bit longer. Unemployment has been on the rise and the governments have been trying to do something about that. And the debt crisis in the Eurozone, every time consumers hear that sort of thing, they say, well, I was thinking about buying a new car. Maybe I'll hang on to my existing car for another year. That's hurt all the car manufacturers here in Europe. It's made them go back to the drawing board and think what to do. And we know General Motors in particular, since that bailout in the US, of course, when the trouble hit the company, it's been looking at its global operations. And there was a lot of fear here in Europe that maybe Opel, the large German brand, or Vauxhall, as the UK people know it. The British know the Opel brand as a Vauxhall. There was a lot of talk that maybe there would be closure of some of the GM factories here in England, for example, or in Germany. But it now looks as though GM has decided Opel is going to stay and the Chevrolet brand, which effectively is a Daewoo here in Europe, is going to go, particularly in Western Europe.
What are analysts saying, Russell? Are they saying this is a good idea?
Yeah, this is effectively a lot of people in the industry are saying, look, GM, what choice did it have? You can't have a troubled market with a company competing with itself. We know GM is suffering loss after loss here. Something I note kind of interesting, we've kind of had a few signals coming down the pike about this. If you've been paying attention to the industry, a really early sign came not so long ago when Susan Doherty, who was the head of Chevy's European operations, effectively was given the heave-ho. She was booted out, and Thomas Cedric, Curran, the head of Opel's strategy, was actually put into the job. So we've seen other interesting managerial changes and pretty interesting that someone who was working at Opel and had seen the success of the German operation suddenly finds himself in charge of the Chevy brand in Europe. And not so long later, Chevy is getting the axe. Well, I actually put this subject to one of the industry analysts here in London. I spoke to Jack Ricks. He's the news editor at Auto Express magazine. And I kind of put it to him, look, this motor company, this American car brand, does it have too many models here in Europe?
It is possible to have an enormous amount of brands. The key is having brands that don't overlap, that don't step on each other's toes. So if we take the VW Group as an example, it's got everything from Lamborghinis and Bugattis at one end through to premium manufacturers Audi. It's then got VW, which sits a little bit below that, and then Skoda, which sits a little bit below VW as well. So they're nicely spaced, they appeal to different buyers, and therefore they can coexist. I think with GM, the problem is that they've had these brands which are not only in a part of the market that's being squeezed, but they're also stealing sales from each other.
Well, that's the key thing, Cindy.
Yes.
Jack Ricks at Auto Express saying, look, the real problem for General Motors, they're competing with themselves. It's tough enough competing with the other competition here in Europe. And if you look at Volkswagen, the group that he cited there, they have got brands that stretch right across the range and they're not competing with themselves. And I suppose when we look at Volkswagen stretching that brand into places like China with great success and looking to develop much more in a significant way in the US, maybe that's the lesson that GM should be looking at. Actually, Cindy, if you're interested, I can tell you how many Chevys were sold here.
Yes.
In the European market. In 2012, Chevrolet sold 195,000 vehicles in Western and Central Europe. And so far this year, the figures I can get are 137,000 vehicles. So you can see it's not selling so many this year in the region as it did last year. But maybe good piece of news in this. It's not the end of the Chevy brand in Europe if you count Russia as being part of Europe, because the General Motors guys know that this brand has had success, even if it's had limited success, and it is a budget brand, and they want to develop the Chevrolet brand, the small budget, fuel-efficient cars in Russia.
You know, it's interesting, Russell, the idea that that analyst raised about the overlapping, because really wasn't that what GM had to address here in the States, which is why we no longer can buy a Saturn, a Pontiac, or an Oldsmobile. They had to look at that overlap as well and tackle that here stateside. I'd like to move now from GM to Ford. The automaker is having a big celebration today, revealing the 2015 Mustang at events all over the globe, from New York to Shanghai to Sydney to Barcelona, and of course here in Michigan and Dearborn. The car goes on sale next fall in the U.S. and then later in Europe and Asia. And this is the first time the Mustang will be sold on these two continents. So, Russell, what do you think is behind Ford's decision to get that Mustang on roads overseas?
It's interesting. We have talked a lot about how this will be the first time the Mustang's on sale in Europe, but that's not quite strictly true. I've seen Mustangs being driven around Europe for many, many years. I know the company is looking particularly to the UK. You must remember, here in the UK and in Ireland too, we drive, from your point of view, on the wrong side of the road. So we need the steering wheel on the other side of the car. That's something Ford's thinking of. But interestingly, this is Ford through its own dealerships now deciding that the brand that they've had for 50 years, they want to cash in on the success of it. And we have seen Dodge, for example, with Challengers here in Europe. So Ford knows this sporty end of the market is something to go for. And the Mustang brand, been around for 50 years. Mm-hmm. It looks like a nice car. It looks attractive. It's sporty. And just maybe it could compete with those cars like Audi, for example. It's not quite in the Mercedes class for the sporting brand, I don't think. But certainly we're looking at this company saying, well, yeah, Audis are selling a lot in Europe. That's a sporty brand. The Mustang could fit in there, and it wants to cash in on that American image. And I suppose, too, a lot of these drivers who would worry about fuel-efficient cars here, which is natural,
yes,
with the price of gas that we pay here in Europe, which can be anything up to double what you're paying in the US, that is a key consideration. But the new Ford Mustang is not like the big V8 of the 1960s or 70s. It is much more fuel-efficient.
So do you expect that this will really help Ford's sales, particularly considering, as we've talked about, the European auto market is, to put it kindly, not in great shape right now?
Well, Ford is one of the companies which actually, you might recall, didn't need a bailout from the US government. It does still push ahead. Ultimately, this is about brand image, about the company pushing forward its own image to customers. And they need the sporty brand to go along with the lower end of the market cars, the budget cars. The Fiesta is quite popular here. The mid-class saloon or sedan, as we would call it here. The Mondeo is also a popular car. The Ford Focus is the real seller here in Europe for Ford. And what the Mustang does is it gets the company's brand image into the minds of drivers. Everybody wants to drive the dream. Sure, they'll sell a lot of Mustangs here, but it's not going to be the massive profit maker they would like. But any car company needs a range of vehicles, and certainly when we look at General Motors having too much of a range of vehicles here in Europe, and Ford is trying to introduce that sporty brand, it knows that segment of the market does have customers, and it can leverage that in other ways, get the blue oval into the minds of prospective car buyers.
Russell Padmore, business reporter for the BBC. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Russell. Thank you so much.
Cindy, good being with you. We'll speak again.
A new statewide poll finds Governor Rick Snyder's approval ratings are holding steady. Michigan State University researchers conducted the State of the State survey this fall. Just 36% of Michiganders surveyed had a positive feeling about Rick Snyder. The governor's poll ratings have held steady during most of his 3 years in office. Charlie Ballard directs the survey.
Certainly, if you're only in the 30s in terms of your positive approval ratings, that's not spectacular.
Meanwhile, President Obama's approval rating in Michigan is at its lowest point in 3 years. The president's approval rating dropped from 45% in the spring survey down to 38% this fall. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time now for our Thursday check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Our first talk since Detroit got the green light to proceed with its historic bankruptcy. Well, Daniel, after Tuesday's ruling in the bankruptcy case, Kevin Orr was making the media rounds, and it certainly seemed that he got testy when the subject of the DIA came up. I believe at one point he said, "I'm done." At the same time, we're getting an early clue about that Christie's appraisal of the art at the DIA. So what have you heard?
Yeah, a couple of things. Yeah, he did say, "I'm done." When he came in to visit us, he made that comment, and he said, "It's our art," meaning the cities, and essentially, I think, has even raised the specter in one of his media appearances that because the city has a contract with the DIA, that they could cancel the contract in bankruptcy if things don't go their way. But that may all be rendered moot. And what I mean by that is the Christie's valuation came in at way under what a lot of people expected. I think people were conservatively thinking that would be $2 billion, and it came in at a range about $470 million to about $860 million.
Hmm.
And so I think what this does is it changes the calculation a little bit. There had been something that we talked about on your show a couple weeks ago after we broke the story mid-November about foundations potentially raising money to put into a pot that would help bolster pension underfunded pensions in exchange for keeping the DIA whole, essentially making sure that it doesn't have to sell any of its art.
And this was the plan kind of instigated by federal judge Gerald Rosen?
Exactly. And at that time, when they thought it was going to be about a $2 billion value on the art, the number that the foundations were kicking around was maybe it would be $500 million they'd have to come up with, which would be a very heavy lift for these foundations, despite their billions in assets.
Mm-hmm.
But now when you have a valuation that comes in maybe around $850 million at the higher end, you may be looking at something considerably less than $500 million.
Something more doable.
And all these things are going to be difficult and one-off special kinds of things for foundations if they were, in fact, to do it. But I think the feeling is, and quoted in my column this morning from somebody that says this is getting better all the time, that it looks more positive, it looks more doable. I think Judge Rosen is clearly on the muscle and would like to see something like this happen. Can't make it happen, but he would certainly like to see it happen because it could help address one of the most knotty problems in the whole bankruptcy.
We probably should note that when Judge Rhodes was handing down his bankruptcy ruling, he certainly did not seem to express a whole lot of support for selling art to meet those short-term cash needs.
No, I think he said three things that I think are really notable in this context. One is he said that, and I've written about this several times over the last few months, is that the guarantees for pensions that are in the state constitution do not apply in federal bankruptcy. Therefore, they do not exist. It was his argument.
Right.
But he also said, I'm not going to approve a plan that treats pensioners too shabbily.
Yes.
So don't come in here with a plan that is very draconian. He also signaled that he didn't think the selling of art to raise short-term cash really fixed the fundamental problems. So I think he's trying to say, look, these are issues. I understand these are issues, but find a way to make this work that isn't so draconian, because I'm not going to approve the plan.
And so this could be the answer to those parameters.
It could certainly help. And I think that's really what they're looking for, is can you get creative here? I think we're moving into a period here where two things are going to happen. Three things. You're going to have your typical legal challenges, which the lawyers are going to do. But mm-hmm. you're also going to have a lot of very creative bargaining and negotiating going on between the city and a lot of different creditors who have different issues that are important to them. And thirdly, I think the expectation is this is now going to move much more quickly, because they're looking at a deadline to file a plan by about the first week in January, which means this thing could hit the same time as the auto show.
Wow.
And even if it slides a week or so, if it slides a week to the second week, then you're in auto show week.
Mm-hmm.
I think the expectation is a lot of these things are going to be moving very quickly as people realize that you've got to get on board. And if you don't cut a deal in advance of that plan being either filed or confirmed, you could end up with a much worse deal, because that's the way bankruptcy works.
So basically, if you don't cut a deal, you're going to have something crammed down your throat.
That's exactly right, and they call it a cram down.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the people that approve, that have a deal with the debtor, they get treated a little bit better because they're cutting their own deal. So they cut their separate deal, and that's incorporated into the plan. And then if you're on the outside, you get whatever's left.
So we've talked about what seems to be working in the favor of this foundation idea. What are the biggest questions or challenges that you see?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is these foundations are led by boards of directors or boards of trustees. They have their own defined missions in terms of what they are able to do and what they invest their money in. They don't typically invest for long periods of time. They don't make an investment that's going to spool out over 25 or 30 years. They might do it over five, and the reason for that is boards of trustees change. Missions can be tweaked. They want to see the results of some of their funding. So it's going to be a question of, can they make a one-off? Can they get their boards to say, yes, let's move forward here? Can they get enough answers to understand how this is going to play out, how the fund would be set up, how it would bolster pensions? I don't think anybody expects that these monies would go directly into the pension funds.
Mm.
They would be there to support the pensions or augment them, I guess is the best way to probably put it. So there's a lot of details they've got to work through, and they don't have a lot of time to do this. As I've been explained to me, endowment funds can take, 6 to 12 months to look at these kinds of things, to come to decisions, and they're not going to have that kind of time.
I would suspect that the whole idea of moving ownership away from the city would sit very well with the DIA leadership.
Oh, I think it would. They've been looking at that since 1997, and on at least, three different occasions in the last 6 years, they've approached the city and asked them to talk about ways to revise the relationship, and the city has rebuffed them for political considerations. And when you look at the politics at the city council table, you can imagine the discussion that would go on about transferring $1 billion or $1.2 billion or $2 billion asset to a regional authority.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, nothing happened. I think this is going to be something that they would clearly want to look at and explore, and it would all be in the details about what kind of entity it actually goes to. But there's no reason that the current leadership and the current board and everything else just couldn't transfer over to whatever that new entity is.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks very much.
We turn now to what is popularly known as the underground economy. When jobs are scarce, people will do whatever they can to put a meal on the table, pay the mortgage or the rent. Whether it's odd jobs, selling plasma, doing home repairs and getting paid under the table, people are doing it. One economist gave a best guess estimate of $2 trillion, yes, I said trillion dollars, worth of this underground activity in the nation last year. That is nearly 8% of the gross domestic product. Reporter Lynn Moore recently wrote a piece about the shadow economy in Michigan for MLive.com. Welcome, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When we think of shadow or underground jobs, it might be quick and easy to think of less than legal activities. But this isn't what the shadow economy is about at all, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think that probably drug dealing is one that immediately comes to mind. But no, there are people out there doing everything from ironing to childcare to any odd job around the home. It's people who are doing whatever they can to make a living and generally not reporting it to the government.
Has it been something that has soared as the Great Recession got its grips around Michigan?
It's hard to know. Economists have a very hard time keeping track. Nobody wants to talk about it, of course, because, I mean, really what they are doing is illegal in a sense that they're not paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at one of the ways you can get an idea about it is looking at the size of the labor force. Before the Great Recession hit, at least in our county, in Muskegon County, the labor market was about 3,000 people larger than it was once the recession hit. And you think, well, where did those people go?
Yeah.
And economists say, you know, those people just tended to give up on looking for jobs and fell out of the job market. Maybe some retired, but perhaps a lot of them just went underground and started working for themselves.
And in doing so, they may be earning money, but they're paying a real price for taking work outside of traditional labor markets. There's no safety net, is there?
Right. There's no safety net. There's no Social Security. They won't be able to collect on their earnings later when they need it through Social Security. If they get injured, when they retire, that money won't be there. Neither will workman's compensation. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times these jobs are dangerous. You know, you've got a lot of construction crews who are being paid under the table. And that's dangerous jobs. And they can get hurt, obviously, but there's no safety net to take care of them like there would be with workman's compensation.
Lynn, give us a couple of typical stories that you discovered of people who are really, you know, living off the grid.
Generally, there would be, I would say, three groups of people who are in this underground economy. The first would be someone who is unemployed, just without any job. And falling in that category was a gentleman I met named Damon Miner. He actually has been unemployed since 2008, looking for jobs on a daily basis, going to the temporary agencies, doing what he can. In the meantime, he's doing odd jobs. He's mowing his neighbor's lawn. When I met him, he asked me if I had any odd jobs. And he's also selling his plasma twice a week. So that's pretty tough on him. Moved in with his parents, really struggling to get by. The second group, I would say, are the underemployed. And that would be similar to a couple that I met who both have college degrees. She is working in retail part-time. She has a sociology degree, and he's an artist, and they just don't have the money to get by, and they're looking to do anything they can, walk dogs, look after people's homes when they're on vacation, again, mow lawns, anything they can do to get them the money that they need to live that is not being provided by these part-time jobs they have. And then the third would be the people who are by choice working in the underground economy, and that would include an executive I know, a former executive, left her job, wanted a more easier life, approaching the age of retirement to get by. She watches her grandkids, and she irons her friend's shirts for work. So, yeah, that's the third group.
Lynn, is there any way to measure the kind of impact that this underground economy has on the state's economy? As you pointed out, it's pretty hard to pin down. Not a lot of people are anxious to talk about that in detail.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, one labor market analyst with the state told me that this is their biggest frustration. They really do not have any clue how that is, you know, affecting the state. But certainly you can imagine that there's probably quite a few dollars missing from our coffers, our government coffers, because these people simply aren't paying their income taxes.
Interesting piece. It's the Work in Progress series on MLive.com, and Lynn Moore's piece is entitled Underground Economy, a Desperate Option When Jobs Are Lacking. Thank you so much, Lynn Moore.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
A major holiday event happens this weekend in West Michigan. Students, teachers, and parents at Mona Shores High School have spent thousands of hours preparing for this performance. They're creating a living, breathing, singing Christmas tree that is 5 stories tall, and it's getting lots of national attention. The Learning Channel featured the singing Christmas tree on one of its holiday shows.
There are trees, and then there are extreme Christmas trees. Some people will take on any challenge when it comes to their trees.
We're crazy.
Stateside's Mercedes Mejia takes us to downtown Muskegon for a preview of the show, now in its 29th year.
Almost 300 students at Mona Shores High School have been practicing for this big show since Labor Day. For an hour every day, they run through classic holiday songs, from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Sean Lawton is the music director at Mona Shores High School, and he's really the mastermind behind this production.
The tree is a 29-year tradition here in Muskegon, Michigan, and it is a 5-story structure holding 220 students. The students that don't fit in the tree kind of are off to the side. It's lit with 25,000 colored lights that are all coordinated to whatever pieces we're doing.
Musical pieces that Lawton says are complicated for singers of any age to perform.
What we're doing here is difficult. It's college-level literature, almost all of it. You know, it's multiple-part harmonies, and when they get in that tree, there's a magic that takes place that's it's undeniable.
The event is a pretty big deal in the Muskegon area. It all begins with the tree. Okay, so this 5-story structure is sitting on the stage. It has 15 tiers that kids stand on, and it's decorated just like Grandma's Christmas tree. Twinkling lights, garlands, giant-sized bows, and big shiny angels, and a big star on top. The scale of the production is massive. There are hundreds of volunteers. They're mostly parents, and they do everything from building the 67-foot tree to chaperoning to handing out props to dressing the kids.
That's fine. We'll be good. If you guys happen to find, though, an overlay that's really bad condition, could you please have it pulled out? We have enough.
Teresa Vredevild is the volunteer coordinator. She directs all the mayhem backstage, and this production is so big, each job has a committee and a chairperson.
I have a candle chair who takes care of the candles for the opening number. There is a tree monkey chair who takes care of the people that climb into the tree and make sure that the kids are safe and help kids who faint out of the tree if they need help.
Kids faint?
Sometimes the kids get a little woozy and then we have them sit down, you know, so that they can come out and they can sit in the back of the tree, get some water.
You can imagine it gets hot up there, especially when you're 67 feet off the ground, surrounded by 25,000 Christmas lights, plus the very hot stage lights. But there are nurses on hand to help out. Choir director Sean Lawton says, even with all that, kids are jumping at the opportunity to do this.
Seems like just about every student prefers to go as high up in the tree as possible. Everybody wants to be up at the top. And so over the years, I've developed a system in which the seniors get to go the highest, followed by the juniors, the sophomores, and then the freshman boys, while the freshman girls end up being off to the side of the tree.
Of course, not everyone wants to be that high. Some kids are afraid of heights. Lawton's daughter, Megan, is now a sophomore, and she was pretty nervous about moving up into the tree this year.
As I was climbing up there, my heart was racing. I was really nervous because I wasn't sure how it was going to be standing up there. I wasn't sure if I was going to have to sit down because I was too scared. But when I finally got up there, I was with my friends, and I was looking around, and I actually found out that it was pretty cool up there.
Hi, I'm Katie Beamer, and I was the angel of the tree on the 15th row. At first I thought it was going to be very scary, but it's actually really, really fun to be up there.
Beamer is a senior now in high school, and she got picked to stand at the tippy top of the tree for her 4th and last year performing in the show. Lucas Cooper will get the chance to move up the tree next year. He's a junior at Mona Shores High School.
Being here is awesome. I love this. I want to be able to do it for the rest of my life, but I can't.
So Cooper won't be able to sing in the tree after next year, since he'll be graduating, but he can join the many Mona Shores alumni who come back to see the show year after year. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
The Mona Shores Singing Christmas Tree will perform three shows this weekend starting today at the Fronthal Center for Performing Arts in Muskegon. And we've put photos of this fabulous tree on our website at michiganradio.org. Still to come, Detroit isn't the only Michigan city facing unfunded pension liabilities and retiree debt. In fact, a surprising number of cities all across our state are facing huge financial problems. We find out more coming up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. A lot of attention has been paid to Detroit's bankruptcy. But if you're in Ann Arbor, Grand Rapids, even Bloomfield Hills, it is so easy to look at Detroit's problem as its problem. But here's a reality check. Detroit is not alone. It's not only Michigan's largest city facing enormous budget challenges. Unfunded liabilities and retiree debt are piling up all over Michigan. Ted Roloffs is a contributing writer to Bridge magazine. His piece is entitled Detroit, Coming to a City Near You. He joins us now. Hi, Ted.
Good to be with you.
And also joining us is John Pato. He's a bankruptcy expert at the University of Michigan. Hello, John. Good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
Ted, I'd like to start with you, kind of give us a sense of what you've put into this story on Bridge, Detroit Coming to a City Near You. You've looked at numbers. You dug into retiree debt and unfunded liabilities in communities all across Michigan. What did you find?
Well, I think to put this in the context of the city that's gotten all the attention, Detroit, now into bankruptcy, I think it's important to look at the forces that put Detroit in that situation and understand how much they apply to other cities across the state, including major urban areas like Grand Rapids, Lansing, Saginaw, Flint, but also maybe surprisingly some smaller communities that one wouldn't necessarily associate with unfunded pension, unfunded retiree health care. So that was the purpose of what we did. And I guess to put it in the simplest terms, what we found is that Detroit remains the extreme example of what can happen, but there are other cities, many cities in Michigan, that are going to be dealing with significant financial stress, likely for many years, because of unfunded pension and unfunded retiree health care.
And in dollars term, as you report in your piece, we're looking at excluding Detroit, unfunded legacy debt in Michigan municipalities topped $10 billion in 2011, and nearly 80% of this debt is tied to retiree health care. And with as you say, hundreds of Michigan communities facing this problem, John, this begs the question, how did we get here?
Well, it's a good question because lots of people want to finger point and say that it was, you know, massive corruption and incompetence in the city council in Detroit, and that's totally different from what we have here. And that's not a complete story and not even a fair story, because there's also been massive depopulation and macroeconomic trends as well that the state is painfully familiar with. So it's a mistake to sort of say, oh, this is just a one-off for Detroit. We have huge liabilities, especially in the health care. And what is a particular perhaps to certain municipalities is that you can retire at a younger age, particularly if you're a police officer and you put in your time, or a firefighter. You know, it's a highly dangerous job. And so once you've put in your time, they let you take your retirement, which is fair. But the flip side of that is it means that you're on the retiree rolls with that health care coverage for some time, well before Medicare ever kicks in. So there's this bridge period when you're a retiree, but you're not even eligible for even the Medicare part of it.
Is this, as you say, totally fair for someone who has been doing a job like police and fire? I know you found some interesting figures in your research. Ted, I see at the high end of Grand Rapids pension scale, the retired fire chief is getting an annual pension of over $97,000 in 2011. Is this because promises were made that seemed good at the time?
Well, I think the way we put this into historical context is to go back to kind of how Michigan was built, looking at the flourishing of the auto industry post-World War II, established kind of the benchmark for pension, retiree health care benefits, as well as wages. That was followed suit by set the pattern for the kind of contracts that municipalities agreed to. And in simplest terms, again, you had an auto industry that built a state and then an auto industry that nearly folded. And that's kind of the essential dynamic force that put us in this situation. As John indicated earlier, many cities lost significant population. They lost tax base. They lost tax revenue. But at the same time, they had these debts that they had incurred over decades. And those debts don't just vanish when your revenues go down.
Yeah, and I think that the retirement is a big issue too. And I think we've seen a change in the entire economy of this with the private sector and now the public sector too. So I think, sadly, that the defined benefit pension plan that these people have is going to go the way of obsolescence. I know at the University of Michigan, for example, I'm in a 403B plan, like a 401K plan. And so I think you're going to see a lot of that shifting. I would be very surprised if any new workers get a defined pension now, and it's all going to be 401K, 403B, I would predict.
So here we have this looming problem with folks that worked, you know, put in an honest life's work and expect to have benefits. And here you have cities, for all of these reasons you talked about, that don't have it. At what point does this become a bigger deal? We're paying so much attention to Detroit. When does the focus get turned outside to the rest of the state? When does the warning bell get rung, and who rings it?
It should be ringing now. Detroit is the warning bell. The fact that it's more accelerated in its financial distress means it was the first to file for bankruptcy. But if these debts can't be – I think what happens – look, if you take a relatively affluent city, like let's say you got Ann Arbor, which by the way is woefully behind on its health care obligations, it still has a good enough credit rating with its other finances that it could probably refinance that debt. So if it assuming it doesn't grow,
okay,
if it's just a question of refinancing, it could stretch that out like a mortgage, right? It could play that over 30 years. So if they funded the deficiency over a long period, that's less scary to imagine. It's just adding on a little bit every year.
All right.
The problem is healthcare expenses grow at a supra-inflationary rate. You see, a pension, we can predict how long people are going to live, what the salary is, so you get X percent times Y years, and you can sort of figure out it's a known unknown.
Got it.
As opposed to the healthcare, people live longer. They put you on machines, and you know the longevity is increasing, and so it's just a dramatically increasing expense. So what you're going to see there is they want to share the risk. Right, because the risk is that it goes up and it's expensive. So you'll see cities asking the retirees to carry that risk through, you know, paying. Let's say that the city pays for, you know, 100% or 90% of your health care. You'll see them going to like a 50-50 split. Or
yes.
In really distressed cities, they'll just say, we can't cover this all anymore.
We're done.
Yeah.
So what we have, I think, and you pointed out so skillfully in your piece in Bridge, Ted, we have a problem that pits retirees against taxpayers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's gonna be played out over the next many years, if not decades. And I think it's going to come in the form of contract challenges, legal challenges. Interestingly enough, in California in 2012, two cities overwhelmingly passed referendums that basically claw back pension benefits and retiree health care benefits. That's now working its way through the court system. It's being challenged by unions there, but you know, there's a pretty stark option right there. Municipality puts it on the ballot, voters approve it, and benefits are taken away. Can that be done? I guess we'll find that over many years in the form of court challenges that may end up in the Supreme Court.
And in addition to the legal angle, there are municipalities who have confronted this. There's some down in there's a mayor of Kentucky. I want to say it was Louisville, but I could get it wrong. It could have been Lexington. I apologize for your Kentucky listeners. There's a way of doing this, right? You can do this by, increasing the contributions. They don't have to be complete cancellation, but you can increase the contributions. You can defer vesting for new people in what these benefits are. And as I said, refinancing of the current legacies as well. So there is a way to sort of, you know, share the pain around. But boy, does that require focused leadership. And, you know, some people just don't want to confront the problem. And if you kick it down the road, that's where you hit bankruptcy.
Because I'm not going to be mayor in 20 years, so I still look good to folks today. And then raising taxes is certainly, you know, some folks, Lincoln is squeaking.
Yeah.
They're pinching the penny so hard. And then you slash spending. That means, as we've seen, you eloquently put it in perspective, Ted, people in Grand Rapids pointing to things that are falling by the wayside.
Yeah, whether it's Grand Rapids or I happen to spend some time in Saginaw just to kind of make the point of what happens in a city when it slashes its budget year after year after year. And to make the point pretty simply, the city stopped cutting weeds in vacant lots, hundreds of abandoned vacant lots in the city, and the city says we don't have $290,000 a year to mow this vacant lot. What does that do to the people left in this neighborhood? What's the kind of meta message to people in that neighborhood about what the city cares about the residents there, and what does that do to property values? What does it do to the future of a neighborhood?
Yeah.
There is an end point to how much cutting you can do in a city. It reaches a point where it becomes self-destructive.
That's right, exactly right, because Ted's talking about when you can get into a tipping point. And once you cut the services so much, and we're seeing this in the discussion with Detroit right now about should we sell off the Detroit Art Museum, or is that sort of cutting off our, our lifeblood of a new development that's going to attract people to the city and have urban growth. And so you can cut, you can cut, you can cut, but once you reach a certain point, you start to make it an unattractive place for people to live in, and you can actually accelerate an exodus, which is then you get a death spiral of the city.
The death spiral, and all across the country. You look at Stockton, California, other bankruptcy cases, and so it feels like this is the lion lurking right around the corner in Michigan in so many areas. So here's a question. Overall, as we look at Michigan, are there leaders willing to follow what you described in Kentucky? Is this a problem that can be fixed? What's the challenge to city leaders? Let's start with the city leaders of today in Michigan. John?
I would say that it's funny. I think that the bankruptcy of Detroit is almost like a politically transformative moment for our state, and it's making people have the discussions we're having right now. And so before, it's too easy to avoid it. Now I think people will confront it more realistically. I think the cities that have had to go through emergency financial managers have confronted it because they go through the books and say, we have to refinance this debt or we have to change these benefits. And I think that the other municipalities out there that will want to avoid financial oversight will have their leadership step up. Whether they take the challenge or not is a question of personal character, and I don't have special insight on that.
What do you think, Ted?
Yeah, I think it's going to take hard work. It's going to take political commitment. It's going to take, at some level, a sense of cooperation between municipality and union groups. And union groups are going to have to recognize that they have a stake in the future of their city as well as a stake in protecting the benefits that they worked for over many years. And understand that at some point when a city does reach that tipping point, that all these benefits can be fragile and they can be taken away.
And if there's not the bold action, as you put it in your piece in Bridge, Ted, what does that mean for Michigan?
Well, that wouldn't be good news, but I really think that's almost not an option because we're at that point. It's not as if this information is unknown. We're reminded of it every day when the news emanates from Detroit. And as John discussed, I think it's very telling that a city reaches the point where it's talking about auctioning off a world-class collection of art to pay a small portion of its $18 billion in debt. And then what does that say about how the city regards itself and how people outside that city regard a city that's taking art off the wall and, out the door, we're going to sell it? It hasn't made that decision, but I think that it's even contemplating that is pretty sobering.
Here's what you do. If you live in a city and you're concerned about this, is when your council representative has the coffee hall or the town meeting. All that is easy to talk about is the current budget. They say, well, this is what we're voting on, the 2014 budget, and here's our thing, and here's our millage rate, and this is what the tax is going to be. And what you need to do is ask about the future and say, well, that's great. Now, what's going on with the retiree and the healthcare obligation? What's our plan? What's the funding of that? And what's our plan to solve that if it's underfunded? Because that should be something that's discussed today and not buried off in the footnote of the budget. And it's only by having the public engaged and facing these issues that I think our political leaders will have the focus to address them.
So it's
absolutely right.
Conversations like this, articles like Ted's in Bridge, And really, as you say, as Detroit's story continues to unfold, it's a lesson for everyone in Michigan.
Absolutely.
We have been speaking with John Pato, who's a bankruptcy expert from the University of Michigan, and he was joined by Bridge Magazine contributing writer Ted Roloffs. And you can find Ted's piece at bridgemi.com. It's Detroit coming to a city near you. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
I enjoyed it.
We got into a little conversation the other day about one of our favorite topics, wine. And when the subject of ice wines and dessert wines came up, more than a few folks seemed a little mystified, as in, what is ice wine? So we felt we needed to spread the word about great Michigan dessert and ice wines, something perhaps to be enjoyed during the holidays and after. Joining us is Courtney Casey from Michigan by the Bottle, which runs a website about Michigan wine and the Michigan by the Bottle tasting room in Shelby Township. Courtney, when we say dessert wine, give us an idea. What kinds are we talking about and why are they extra good when it's cold?
Well, there's definitely quite a range of dessert wines available in Michigan. One of my favorites is ice wine. And the coolest thing about ice wine, I think, is actually the story about how it comes to be. It's definitely a lot of work and dedication by the winemakers to make this particular style of wine. They have to let the grapes freeze on the vine, and they have to let them get down to a certain temperature for several days in a row before they can actually be qualified as ice wine. And so once those grapes are frozen on the vine, then they pick them while they're frozen and press them while they're frozen, and they only get basically a drop of juice out of every grape, and the sugars are super concentrated because that grape is frozen.
Ah.
So a lot of times you'll see that ice wines are significantly more expensive than a traditional wine just because of the limited yield of frozen grapes and also just the effort that goes into it and the fact that there's a lot of risk of letting those grapes hang that long to let them freeze. There can be animals that come and eat them. They could get rotted. So it's kind of a risk on the winemaker's part.
Do we serve ice wine chilled?
Yep, you serve ice wine chilled, and you definitely want to do it more in, like, small sips. It's not the kind of wine that you pour a full glass of, and I think the price usually will deter people from trying to do that anyway, but it's definitely a very sweet, very concentrated sweetness. So it's more of like sitting there with a small glass with a few sips, an after-dinner drink, or, you know, with dessert or as a dessert on its own.
Okay. What's your favorite Michigan ice wine?
Oh, God, there's so many that I love. We serve the Vidal Blanc ice wine from Sandhill Crane here, and we serve that with a cranberry pecan toffee as a dessert pour, and that is delicious. But there's so many around the state that I love. Domaine Berrien has a Cabernet Franc, so if you're looking for a red ice wine, that one's kind of an unusual one. Bry's Estate up in Old Mission has the best-in-class dessert wine from this year's Michigan Wine Competition with their dry ice Riesling ice wine. And Black Star Farms, I'm not sure if they produce any of this latest vintage, but they, in the past, have had one called Acapella ice wine, and that one is to die for. Fenn Valley had one that was super affordable and really tasty that won awards several years in a row called 42 ice wine.
Sounds really, really good. You've given us, I think, some ideas for our holiday entertaining. Courtney Casey runs the Michigan by the Bottle tasting room. It's in Shelby Township, and you can check out the website, michiganbythebottle.com. Well, happy entertaining over the holidays, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully people will be picking up some ice wine from Michigan wineries for their holiday gifts.
And a holiday note before we go, the note of a little ringing handbell. The Salvation Army's Red Kettle campaign's in full swing, and those coins and bills stuffed into kettles help needy folks all over Michigan. This Saturday, I am manning a red kettle at the Kroger store on Coolidge at Maple and Troy from 10 a.m. to noon. If you're in the area, please stop by and say hi. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk Monday at 3 o'clock. We'll